Hey, Orlando. Tired of battling the mighty pollen? We've got your back. Aspire Allergy and Sinus offers lasting allergy relief so you can chuck those temporary fixes and savor that sweet, sweet taste of victory over pollen. With same-day results and tailor-made treatment plans, we've turned the tables on allergies. Aspire patients enjoy relief that lasts for years. Schedule your appointment today at AspireAllergy.com. Turn your daily sneeze-a-thon into a breeze with Aspire Allergy and Sinus. Go to AspireAllergy.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In the My Seven Wonders podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. And the guest who joined me for this recording is a comedian, actress, writer, singer, a regular performer in Edinburgh, around the country, and on TV comedy shows. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Tiff Stevenson.
Hello. There we go.
Hello.
So, sit you down. I know it's your sudden, or your proper stand-up comedian. You want your microphone in your hand. But...
I do. And I also saw a clock on the table and I was like, oh my God, I immediately feel pressure.
you don't feel pressure. And if I don't do it right, then people start rushing out to go and see the other shows that they're going to go to, assuming they are. So welcome. Now, you're a regular here at the Edinburgh Festival. You've come for many years, haven't you?
I have, yeah, yes. Quite a few. I think this is my 10th solo show.
Yes, and as I mentioned, you were also in, you sort of act. I think you started doing acting before you did stand-up comedy.
Yep, I was acting in various TV shows. One of the earlier things I did was I did an episode of The Office.
The
UK. Yes. It was really fun. Actually, at the time, I'd auditioned for a different part, and my agent at the time, no longer, so I can do an impression of her.
Yes.
Said, darling, I think you do want to take this part because it's too small, and you're just going to be seen as this bit part actress. And I said, but the script's really funny.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, fine, don't listen to me. And then I did it. And it was a huge amount of fun. And no one knew that it was going to become this phenomenon at the time. Obviously, you know, we were shooting in like Twickenham in a nightclub for 3 days. And I just knew the scripts were really funny. So that's why I wanted to do it. And then it's gone on to be, you know, I used to get residual checks from it and I'd be like, what is this? And they'd sold it in another country.
Yeah.
So it just like rumbled on and became bigger than we ever thought.
That's good money, that, isn't it? When it comes in later, you haven't done any extra work for it.
Yeah, you're like, a treat.
they've eliminated most of those, so you're lucky to get those. So what was that? What is that working with Ricky Gervais? Because he's quite a character and he's got his own opinions about everything.
Yes, I mean, I think at the time, Ricky was very much... He was sort of open to suggestions from actors on his performance and stuff. That might have changed now. Because at the time, that was sort of the breakthrough thing. I know he was doing sort of the 11 o'clock show and stuff, but he was like, you know, is my drunk acting good? And always the rule for me, if I'm doing drunk acting, and I've done it quite a lot, I don't know why people see me as an alcoholic, but is always to act sober. Because drunk people are normally trying to fight the fact that they're quite as drunk as they are. So, so he was like open to suggestions and stuff from the cast and people improvising. And he was fun to work with. That was him and Stephen. So Stephen was sort of overseeing and directing as well on the episodes. Yeah.
Right. Now, just before we get on to your wonders, the thing that's often noted about you in early life is your father, when you were growing up, ran Wembley Stadium. And that meant you met... lots of famous people. I assumed from that, because that's the way my brain, you must have met lots of footballers. But then it goes on to, it mentions, you know, more rock stars and things like that.
Yeah, he was the box office manager at Wembley when I was a kid. And so I think I didn't really ignore, it just means I'm not really impressed by a lot. Because I met lots of people when I was a kid that I was like, you just meet these people. Yeah. Like I went into Annie Lennox's dressing room and just like literally sat on her lap as she was doing her makeup backstage, which is so precocious, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I had no idea. She was just lovely and warm. And I think I met John Moss from Culture Club.
Yeah.
And like he gave me a signed album and stuff. But I just didn't really... I wasn't really aware. I was more interested in the fact that in my dad's office, there were boxes of stationery and that you could get like, there'd be like a box of 100 green pencils and 100 pink pencils. And I was like, I can have one of each colour and do some drawing. Yeah. And that was more exciting to me at the time.
So you could just wander around the dressing rooms of the rich and famous. Those were more innocent times.
More innocent times. Yeah. All access passes.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah. So I don't think I quite. If it was now, I would be probably overwhelmed with like having the opportunity to do that. But like back then, I was just like, yes, Dad's work, and I didn't. You know.
Yeah. So he sometimes brought his work home with him as well. Did he bring home rock stars, or was it just?
No. Okay. There's no rock stars that came home. I actually, what's interesting is that I remember very distinctly that when my dad left, lots of friends left as well. So I learned quite a lot about people. Yeah. I think while
left his job.
Left his job. Yeah. That lots of friends sort of disappeared. That would be like, you know, you'd get Christmases and there'd be Fortnum and Mason hampers that would turn up. I remember this gigantic fish one year, I put my finger in it and it clamped down. And that's the only thing I remember of that. But I remember
A living fish?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's a reflex or something that can still happen afterwards. That was just like I was probably like 6 or 7. I just remember it. And we used to get like this, come stay in our place for a holiday and come and do, you know, and then when the job with all the perks went, a lot of people went with it. So that I learned a lot about humans.
All right. Okay, well, let's get on with your seven wonders. And we're kind of in that world because your first wonder is Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, the title of your podcast is one of their songs.
Yes.
And it's the alarm clock that wakes me up in the morning. So when I set my alarm, I hear Stevie singing Seven Wonders.
I wondered if we should have had that music played in at the beginning or the end, but I thought it's a bit obvious to. But now I'm slightly regretting.
Oh no,
I'm slightly regretting
something
it now.
Obvious.
No, it's obvious as a sort of theme tune. But
yes.
No, I mean you're entitled to have Fleetwood Mac, and they are. I'm sure people almost everywhere is familiar with them, but they are. They have lived a rock star life as a band and individually to the nth degree. If you think of anything that rock stars have ever done, they've done it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's like this iconic example of the special relationship, because it's Americans and Brits together combined, all the best and worst parts of that. And I think for me, I mean, I used to do a bit in my stand-up, actually, when you're saying about rock and roll lifestyle. I used to do a bit about Stevie Nicks, like how heroic it was that she would just do all of that, because it can mess with your you know, there were rumours of certain substances. There you go. I can get away with that.
No, you can get away with beyond that. I've interviewed Mick Fleetwood, and so I looked up my notes for that, and I can't say if it's between them or just him. But he estimated $65 million worth of cocaine they had used. But
I'd say
it might have been between them. It might have been just him. It might have been just that week. I don't know. But, sorry, 60 million. I've added five. $60 million.
Yeah. It might have been after that disastrous Brit Awards with Samantha Fox.
Yes.
I remember that. But, you know, only a man and a woman can only hope for that level of rapport when they host something together.
Well, he is about 7 foot tall and she's about 5 foot tall. So even on that level, they couldn't even get the camera shot to have them both in it, could they?
No. And I mean, that whole period in time where they were all sort of sleeping with each other, sleeping with other people. Two things struck me. So one was the Stevie, because it did affect her voice. I used to do a thing on stage where I'd do Stevie Nicks turning into Cartman, because she'd start beautifully and then eventually get really nasal.
Can you do that without having musical accompaniment?
Do you want a blast?
Yes, I'd say.
You want to do a blast?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Stevie Nicks, Cartman. All right. Now here you go again, you say you want your freedom, but who am I to bring you down? It's only right that you should have you any dreams you'd like to share? Dreams of loneliness like a hippie dreams you miss.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm going to see if I can get you to do an impersonation with each wonder.
But one of the central things about that, I think, is is the fact that Stevie and Christine had this amazing relationship.
Yeah.
That could have been like, I think that there's a, she joined the band and then she's like 10 years younger and is immediately put up as the front woman.
Yes.
And I think a lesser or a more insecure musician and writer would have like found that threatening. But I read lots of interviews with them and they said, actually, they like when it was just one woman in the band, you had no voice. And then all of a sudden there was two of us and we could actually make changes and and push things forward. So I think from that point of view, I think that it was a really a great example of like female solidarity in like one of the biggest rock groups in the world.
Well, it's an extraordinary history all around because the band was started as a blues band by Peter Green.
Yes.
And then because he was going through a bad patch, he kind of bequeathed it to Fleetwood and Mac, you know, McVie. So they got the name. So the drummer and the bassist have then been in charge from then on. They've recruited and then married girls that have come in, women have come in. And then Rumours, the album is brilliant because instead of them writing songs about being rock stars and having too much money, they're writing songs about sleeping with each other, falling out, having an argument. And it's a brilliant album. As a rotten, you know, one voice is singing about the seeing the words written by the writer who's fallen out with the singer.
Yes.
And it's quite
yes.
unbelievable.
John's got to play a song about Christine falling in love with a You Make Loving Fun. And it's not about him.
Yeah. It's about the lighting director.
So I love that. I love it. And then, of course, there was Stevie had an affair with Mick at one point. Yeah. And also just the skill, like Lindsey Buckingham, like for me, is like one of the best guitar players in existence.
He's not in the band anymore. He's been in and out, hasn't he?
He's been in and out. And Neil Finn, I think, from the Crowdies, who I absolutely love, Crowded House, has been sort of doing some shows. But Lindsey Buckingham, for me, is, you know, I just don't know if it's the same without Lindsey being there. So,
They brought Lindsey in, but he brought Stevie in. Am I getting the right combination?
That's right.
There were a couple at that stage.
There were a couple, and there were Buckingham Nicks, I think it was called there.
Yeah.
And they were musically a couple and together as a couple. And then I think Mick was maybe at studios and heard Lindsey and was like, we're looking for someone else. And he sort of said, well, we're in a band together, so you take both of us or none of us. And then Fleetwood Mac was in that version, that iteration was born, and
So which period of Fleetwood Mac do you go for? Because they had the early blues, then they had a huge hit with Albatross, which is like nothing else.
Yes.
And then they've got all, you know, the Rumours and then subsequent albums, which are...
I'm sort of about Rumours and I'm sort of about the 80s. I'm kind of like, I was obsessed with this sort of Stevie. I think a lot of the things in my career has just basically been me trying to be Stevie Nicks in some version or another. But, you know, the big hair 80s, the gypsy fairy, witch vibe.
So would you have liked to have been in a band like that? Because it's...
I think I would have.
Yeah.
Definitely. And my ego would say I'd want to be the lead singer.
So would you have welcomed in another female singer to balance it out? Or
I would welcome in someone whose talents were different to my own.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Christine recognised, that Stevie just brought something very, very different from... She has much more of an earthiness, you know. She's on keys. She's a songwriter. And the blending of the voices, their voices blended so well, so beautifully together. And sometimes, you know, it's just about finding the right people to make a bit of magic happen. And so for me, when I hear those songs and songs like Landslide, as I've got older, like when I hear songs like that and actually watching that played live and watching Stevie and Lindsey, like kind of communicating with each other on stage. It's really, really magical and beautiful and quite like emotional.
Well, this is a very, very good choice, I may say so. But I can't help being reminded that in his book, there are times when they're going to gigs, concerts in 14 separate stretch limos because they're not talking to each other except on stage, and they all have to have a limo. They've made fortunes of money, though Mick Fleetwood has been bankrupt twice in the course of all this. Rock star lifestyles are just fantastic to observe from the outside. They do that for us to be entertaining. They play the music and they have these ludicrous lifestyles. But maybe you have this lifestyle as well.
I've used 15 independent limos at this festival. So I feel like it's all part of the journey and the art, and that's rock and roll. You've got to have, you look at the Eagles or, you know, like you want to kind of see these grand, big, you don't want everyone to get along all the time, because sometimes when the fights, the passion comes out of that and they create brilliant things out of it.
Right.
So there has to be a push and pull. If they all agreed with each other, they probably wouldn't be making music as amazing as it is.
Well, that's certainly the logic behind Fleetwood Mac. But so your second wonder is accents. And that's the only... I have that word. I don't know which direction you're going with, whether it's punctuation in French or it is the way different people speak. I don't know.
It's how people speak.
Yeah.
I find it endlessly fascinating, especially if I'm trying to create work or create a show. And often, if I'm writing an Edinburgh show, snippets of overheard conversation can become basis of a whole routine. And the basis of accents, where they come from, why they sound a certain way. I was listening to NPR last time I was in America, and there was a man on, he was, I think he was from Alabama,
yeah,
but as he was speaking, it sounded like he was trying to swallow secrets the entire time. And I was just sort of fascinated to kind of go, how did this voice appear, and why does it evoke that he's like got something he doesn't want to say, you know? And I was on the High Line in New York, and I overheard a fantastic... This became a routine from a show. So it was back in about 2016 or 17. There was a tour guide, and he had a group of about 20 people. And I just heard him say, "Okay, this is pier number 27. This is where the Titanic was supposed to dock. Now, we all know what happened here. Tragedy." Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
Right, hilarious, yeah. Right? So I was stood with my partner, and I was stood with my friends who we were staying with in New York, and they saw me get the phone out, and they were like, "Of course," because immediately I just wrote the sentence down, and I was like this very kind of strong New York accent, this guy, and it took me a while to sort of figure out what that meant. I knew I wanted to put it in the show. I was like, "Oh, what's going to happen when he gets to the 9/11 memorial? This is terrifying," you know. And I was like, "What does this man represent?" And sometimes it takes me a while, like I say. About 6 months of thinking on this, and I realized in the context of the show and in the context of my brain, this man represented all of us in the face of rolling news and tragedy and, you know, extreme weather events and people dying and celebrities dying. And you barely have time to acknowledge a tragedy or what's happened before you have to move on.
Now the sports news.
Yeah. Yes. So it was about how we absorb, you know, all of this stuff going on all the time. We're in 24-hour, and Americans and British people do it very differently. I think Americans are used to that rolling news coverage, and they have therapy and they're happy to talk about it. Whereas I think British people are a bit like, "What are you doing going to see a professional? Yeah. You bring that to Christmas dinner and ruin it like everyone else." So that was just hearing accents or hearing certain voices, like my grandmother. So my dad's side of the family are like Scottish Presbyterians, so I would always like listen to my dad's side of the family, their Scottish accents. My dad was born in Prestwick, but they all had that kind of east coast of Scotland, and I'm always fascinated
Prestwick's west coast of Scotland.
Well, he was born in Prestwick, but they were, my grandma was from St Andrews, so east coast.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes, should clarify.
No,
yes,
I shouldn't interrupt. But people think Prestwick.
No, Prestwick is west.
I come from Ayr.
Prestwick's Ayr, my now fiance is from Ayr as well. So, is a weird little sound they make there.
Yeah.
So I always had, and when I come here, in fact, I once. Again, so this fascinates me, and I'm like, where does this come from? I rang the landlord in Edinburgh to pick up my keys one year, and this woman answered, and she went, "Good afternoon." And I was like, is she holding on to the vowels in case the English steal them? What's happening here? So I'm sort of fascinated by that. That was like my grandmother's side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like that Professor McGonagall kind of... But it's a very proper sort of sound.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated to like how that shapes and why. Why does it have clips on certain words? Or you get, if you ever go to Los Angeles, there's a lot of particularly women in Los Angeles who talk like their voice is running out of batteries. Like this kind of, if you ever watch Selling Sunset, they're like, "Hello, Heather, Kashal, yeah." And then it's called vocal fry as well, because they on the end of the words.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that developed. Is it because men find it attractive if you sound like you're on 20%? I don't know. So I just hear a voice and I like
no,
to...
No, it's good. I haven't had that pointed out before. That's very good. Do you do it in Scotland? Because there's a, you know, Edinburgh and Glasgow are quite close together as cities, but they're completely different accents.
They are. And I'd probably not be thanked for my attempt at a Ouija accent. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot more front of the mouth, I think, in a Glasgow accent. Are there any Glaswegians in?
Yeah.
Aye. One then. I like. A fun thing that I used to do was do. And a comedian brought this up to me the other night, and I'd forgotten that I did it. He was like, "Do you remember when you used to do raps with different accents?" So I would do like a Scottish Vanilla Ice or a Glaswegian, okay. Ice Baby or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I would play around with just putting these different voices into different contexts. That for me is fun and fascinating. Yeah. How would you describe your accent? RP?
Well, I'd say it was a BBC accent. I'm quite good at some accents. I didn't know why this story came to mind. Before I was on telly and radio and stuff, I was a barrister. And there was one occasion I was prosecuting a case at the Old Bailey. The defendant was Glaswegian. But he was kind of like a clan war, but in somewhere in outer London. And my family's from Glasgow, so I could understand him. But literally nobody else in the court could. The judge is supposed to write everything down, and I could see the judge gave up because he wouldn't. He had all got a start, and he obviously was giving evidence. He's embarrassed. He didn't want to give. He was although he got off most charges just because nobody could work out what had gone on. So it's a rare case of a barrister telling a story with a particularly sexual. It was just the absurdity that nobody could understand it, but that's I was used to it. But
some American friends went to see Burns, I think. Alan Cumming was doing here, and they were like, we didn't know what was happening. And I was like, that's because it's but like I was like, a lot of Scottish people would like, you know, for a full hour of
it is
wee timorous beastie. It's you know, you've really got to tune your ear into hearing it.
Well,
right?
I've seen it, and it's largely dance, and there's music, and he's speaking Alan Cumming voice rather than it's not huge amounts of old Scots poetry, so I think they weren't concentrating. It's a brilliant show.
I was expecting Ode to a Louse or
he does do Scots Way Hay, or, you know, that's just, he does quite a dramatic bit with that. And he's just lots of his letters as well. And I wouldn't go reviewing it. It's a very good performance. But anyway, so accents. So we've covered
accents. Yeah. Well, yeah. And you said yours is BBC English.
Well, I think everybody should think their accent is the standard and everything else is different.
Yes.
So I've never understand when people say, oh, you won't understand me here because I don't speak English. Yes, you do. You speak English probably. It's just it's different from everybody else. But I think I've fitted in with, being in court and being on BBC. But it's no good now because nobody wants my voice, even on Radio 4. We want to move on from that.
I often wondered if I had this sort of voice, you know, like a Joanna Lumley type.
Yes. Yes.
What, do you feel the energy change?
Yeah.
There's a frisson, you see, when you. That's this is the kind of voice I believe men in power like to hear. Sexual frisson from Joanna.
Yeah.
You see, it's like she could tell Boris off, and I think he'd probably enjoy it, actually. Yeah.
She managed to get all those pensions for the Gurkhas just by going. A Gurkha campaigner saying, oh, we want more. Nothing, but she, oh, you must give. It's so unfair.
This isn't just injustice. This is Marks and Spencer's injustice.
Well, I think it's a good voice to go for if you're going to change your accent. Joanna Lumley is a good one.
It would be that, or it would be like a received pronunciation. The other one, the BBC English, I would never forget. I met a girl who came out of drama school and talked a little bit like a lamb. And then she got lots of sort of stuff that was like sort of plays and radio plays. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I should just change my voice to this then. I think it sounds very 1940s.
It does. It's very good. But what you're illustrating, you can do a whole range of voices and accents. So that's you should.
If you're fascinated with something, you end up tuning into it, I think, and just becoming obsessed.
Well, it, what strikes me is there's the two elements you've got in when you can do different voices. You've got to make the observation of what's going on, work it out, and then you've got to have the capacity to do it. And not all of us can do that. So that's a double skill you've got to have. Have you always had that skill? Were you one of those irritating children at school impersonating the teachers and things like that?
I did, yeah. I think I was irritating. I think I'm still irritating. I do. And sometimes socially, and I don't know whether this is just a particularly female thing, but sometimes you pick up, because I live with a Scottish partner, you know, I'm in the house with him. So I find myself, and I'm sort of slipping into a slightly... Yeah. Ayrshire kind of, yes. You know, if I'm around him and it, with his family. So I find my accent sort of ebbing away. And yeah. Then I get back to London. I'm like, here it is. Because my dad is Scottish, but he's lost his accent, but retains his hatred for the English. So that's useful.
I used to do programmes with John Session. We did Whose Line Is It Anyway? And we went to New York a couple of times to record things. I don't know why we go. But John Session is a great mimic, and he can do all sorts of voices. And in New York, he just absorbed New York voices. So in concert, we were recording stuff, and he had a New York accent, which in England or in Britain, it would have been impressive. Oh, John Session's doing that voice. But in America, he's just talking normally. So John, what are you doing this for? Stop. And he wasn't really aware of it. He was just absorbing it as he went around.
You have to, for that, that's a slightly different thing. But I did a film last year and I played an American in it. And I was so conscious that when I see clangy accents in films, I find it really upsetting. Mm. Someone sent me a clip the other day and I'd never seen it before of Al Pacino doing Cockney. And by God. He kept talking about a dog. What did he say? Little tiny little Duchess hand. It was amazing. Yes. It was all about dog racing, and I'd never seen it before. And I was like, wow. And I think whoever put it up had put, we give Dick Van Dyke a lot of grief, yeah. But why is no one mentioning this? So with my accent, I did that thing. I became that actor that was a bit like, ugh. So as soon as I got in the makeup chair, I was in my character's voice. Because especially if you're going to improvise or play when you're, you know, recording stuff and you've got these long days, if I kept coming out of it in between to like talk to the you know, the spark or the director of photography or whatever and come back to Tiffany, then I immediately go back in and I've lost something. You lose like a certain percentage of it, so you've got to.
So would you say you're a method impressionist?
I didn't think I was going to Daniel Day-Lewis it, but I did. I didn't stay in the swamp and go have lunch without me. I did. Yeah, I tried to stay in the accent just to give myself, because I don't want people to watch it and go, oh, what is that? And I'm sure there'll be points, but there's just certain things, you know. And it's interesting because when people write it as well, I'm watching this show on Amazon Prime called The Boys, which is amazing, but they've got a Cockney character in it. And some of the stuff I'm like, please just get someone in from the UK. They don't even have to be from London.
Yes.
But they could tell you that they don't say things like twat. No one in the UK says that word, you know, so...
Well, I'll just leave it at that. You don't... Yeah, you
Am I allowed to say that here? It's not
you
a rude word.
You can say what you
here,
like. You can say what you like, but... Yeah. Anyway, we're going to move on anyway, because you've got to get through some more of these wonders. Otherwise, well, I don't know what, but I'd feel personally letting myself down. So your third wonder is Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect. I assume that's who you mean. And this is another Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright...
It's an ex-boyfriend of mine, actually, so we're going to do...
It could be a boxer. No, it's Frank Lloyd Wright. So is it his? You're interested in architecture. You love his buildings. Something about him. What?
All of those things. I like how that got a from the audience. But I think what fascinates me about Frank Lloyd Wright, his journey. I think he grew up in like quite a working class sort of background, and worked his way up from draftsman to, I think, stealing some of his boss's clients, if I remember correctly from the stuff I've sort of read and watched, and to become this architect that was like pushing boundaries and then was completely dismissed in his sort of 40s and 50s, and then came back to do his most iconic stuff in his 80s and 90s. So for me, that is like, that's so inspiring that your best work is always in front of you, because it's hard to see that sometimes. And it can be, especially coming up to, I'm in my 40s, I come up to this festival and everyone's like, is it your first show? We're not really interested. Yeah. Unless like, you want to get some press coverage or whatever. And you go, oh yeah, I'm not 20. Mm. But like, I think I have something to offer. And we always see these you know, 30 under 30 lists. And I'm like, what about 50 under 50 or 60 over 60? Yeah. You know, I want to find out what people are doing later and if they've changed entire careers. So he did the Guggenheim when he was 90, and he did Falling Water, I think, at 82.
Yeah.
So that I'm fascinated with him. And I think he might have been a little bit of a, what was I going to say, problematic, I guess is the word we'd currently use. Like, he might not have been amazing to his ex-wife and, you know. So, but I kind of interested in looking at his work and his journey and the fact that he did so much late.
Well, on his personal life, it's almost back into the Fleetwood Mac territory, because he did leave his wife and left her for somebody called Mama Cheney, who was then murdered by a servant, and the whole building and sat on fire, which is, you know, in a sense, nothing to do with him, but it was a tremendous tragedy in everybody's life there. And then he had another wife who he got married. He wasn't married to Mama, but then he married somebody else, and that he fell out with her, and then had a later wife with very publicly with a third. So he had quite a sort of rock star-y kind of range through
Henry VIII approach.
Yes.
I think it was at Taliesin that happened, because then he also created this school of architecture and stuff as well. And I think the first time I ever sort of really was made aware of Frank Lloyd Wright, it was actually Mike McShane.
Who's Lion Man.
Yeah. And I'd gone to Los Angeles for the first time, and I was in Los Feliz, and he was like, there's lots of Frank Lloyd Wright here. And he was sort of pointing out stuff to me. So then I went away and just looked at, and I'd seen pictures of Falling Water before. And if you don't, lots of people might know it, but if you don't, it's a house in, I think it's like one of the, is it a wonder or a, it's a listed, not a listed it, building. What do they call it in America?
It's sort of, do you know, I had a note of this and I haven't, Falling Water, yes. It's, I haven't got the note of that. It's in the Johnson Wax building as well. Anyway,
it's a personal, interest.
It's a private house,
yes,
but for a very, very wealthy person. It's their second home, and it's built over a waterfall.
It's built over a waterfall because he was like, we can't combat this, so we work with the waterfall. But I think it's like open to the public now as a place of interest or whatever, like a heritage site.
Yeah, it's a museum there.
Yes, like yeah. And it's in Pennsylvania, and it's just, you see pictures of it and you kind of go, wow, that's, you know, there's a brilliant mind that's come up with this and this most beautiful sort of house working with nature. It's part of nature. So that was, I think, then I started researching that, and I haven't been to see it yet. My plan was to in 2020, but a little thing got in the way.
Okay.
So then that's when I became fascinated, and then looking at the Guggenheim and all of these other buildings. And the fact that he was dismissed and kind of told that what he was doing didn't really matter, and he didn't let that dissuade him from just going on and producing brilliance.
And there was a sort of battle between, an argument, him and Le Corbusier, who is a much more, more sort of brutal and dominating kind of architecture. He believed in more organic growth and fitting in with what's there already, which I think is probably more acceptable nowadays. Or it's got its way now, hasn't it?
Yeah. And I think there was as much a rivalry, but Charles Rennie Mackintosh and Frank Lloyd Wright were sort of doing different, you know, opposite sides of the Atlantic, you know, doing like who copied who. I think there were like I'd be fascinated to know if they ever communicated and what that would be like, these kind of, you know, these two men doing you know, amazing work. I'd love to. That would be a TV show I would love to watch. The letters, two of them writing letters. So I'm just pitching TV
Well, that's a very good pitch. This may or may not be the people you need to pitch it to, but there's a television festival at the end of the week.
Would you watch it? Yeah. I'd watch it.
Yes.
Watch
Are it. You going around looking at his buildings, Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, and rivals, and taking in. In Glasgow, assuming any of his buildings haven't burnt down recently, you can do. So, yes. So, but and you never went into architecture. This is an enthusiasm.
No.
It's not.
No, it's an enthusiasm. And I think maybe in another life I would have loved to have. I don't know whether I would have had the talent and the ability to be able to, but I am fascinated by buildings and their mark that they leave around them and what they represent. And
another good show by Frank Lloyd Wright, and he even had a song about him by Paul Simon. No, it wasn't really about him, but his name's in the title.
He gets a mention.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, Dallas, tired of battling the mighty pollen? We've got your back. Aspire Allergy and Sinus offers lasting allergy relief so you can chuck those temporary fixes and savor that sweet, sweet taste of victory over pollen. With same-day results and tailor-made treatment plans, we've turned the tables on allergies. Aspire patients enjoy relief that lasts for years. Schedule your appointment today at AspireAllergy.com. Turn your daily sneeze-a-thon into a breeze with Aspire Allergy and Sinus. Go to AspireAllergy.com.
So your fourth wonder is Maya Angelou. So we're back in America, but a different type of person altogether.
Yes, I think I first read I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings in school, and it was one of those books that just kind of like opened up a whole new world, ideas, how to, it gave a lot to me in terms of like American history, I think, through the eyes of this one woman in Stamps, Arkansas. And, you know, obviously there's stuff about racism and segregation and the sort of hangover of sort of Jim Crow and stuff like that. And she writes so beautifully, and there's an immediacy to her writing that you're completely in her world. And then aside from just the books, because there's like Gather Together in My Name and all, you know, I've read all of those, and that's very much her journey through life, and then part of the civil rights movement later on, and when she did Porgy and Bess and all of that kind of stuff, but her poetry as well, that, you know, you can tune into, and it just becomes the most sort of uplifting, magical thing to, if I'm having a down day, I'll reach for a piece of her, you know, even friends who have funerals when great trees fall, you know, she has something for, I feel like, every human emotion and every moment, phenomenal woman, that I look for. So I just love, and I love watching her speak. She does an interview with Dave Chappelle, and it's called Iconoclast, and it's so beautiful watching her speak to him, and her continued like graciousness even when awful things happen, and how she manages to see the humanity in people and the power of words. She talks about that quite a lot in how I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, because she has an awful thing happen to her as a child, and she doesn't want to tell anyone. She doesn't want to say the name of the man who's done it, and then she says the name, and her uncles kill him when he's let out of the courthouse. And then she has this thing of going, the power of my word took someone's life. And she becomes mute for like a number of years, and then goes on to be the person who's like creates all of the words and writes all of the poems and all of the books. And so she always had this thing of like, she believes words are things. They're like in the air. They're like objects, and they have power. Mm. And so, you know, and she talks about certain words of going, you know, there's words that, you know, are not nice words, and you can pour, I think she said something like, you can pour poison in a crystal glass, it's still poison. So I'm fascinated to hear, and no shame around about who she is and what she's done and where she got to in her life. I think she'd been nominated for a book prize, and a journalist was going to be talking to her about the book, and she just sort of ambushed her by saying, you were a prostitute. And then, like, how Maya Angelou handles that is so amazing. It was like, Maya was like, this was an attempt to sort of shame me for the fact that I'd been involved in, you know, what I'd done when I was younger. And she just kind of took it on and owned it and went, you can't shame me if I'm not shamed.
Yes.
Like, you don't have the power to do that. So I think she's, yeah, I think she's, you know, she's brilliant. And I, you know, I wish she was still here to be continuing to be brilliant.
Well, I mean, I to sort of summarise, she had a really, really, you know, difficult start in life, family life, you say, you know, abuse at home or more or less at home. And then a rough life trying to make a living, a bad early marriage as well. And yet that skill of writing was and skill with words was developing, despite that or because of that or because she had so many life experiences. Would you say it's kind of a separate thing? Or
No, I think it's all infused in her work. It's definitely it's a huge part of who she is and how she writes, I think. And I think... Actually, I like the kind of personal narrative of being able to see a movement and a moment in time through the eyes of one individual. And I think she sort of said as well, her family in Stamps, the reason she'd gone to live with their grandmother was because they were quite middle, like they owned a store.
Yeah.
So actually she was like, we weren't, necessarily. Yeah. But she was also the first, I think she was the first female conductress on the they call it, is it the trolley car?
Your streetcar would have been.
In St. Louis.
Yeah.
Like she was the first, like she went to go and try and get this job and they kept saying no and they kept saying no and she persevered. And so, you know, she's someone who just, she used to dance calypso in clubs and then coming through with people like Phyllis Diller and stuff at the Purple Onion. And so there's comedy intertwined with all of that as well. So just like, I can't recommend highly enough, like reading all of her books.
I like, she had a ritual for writing. So she said, I've got a note here, she had a writing ritual for many years. She would wake early in the morning and check into her hotel room.
Yes.
Where the staff were instructed to remove any pictures from the walls. She would write on legal pads while lying on the bed with only a bottle of sherry, a deck of cards to play solitaire, Roger's Thesaurus and the Bible, and would leave by the early afternoon.
So brilliant.
The bits I like there are the bottle of sherry and the leaving by early afternoon. I think that's that's fantastic. She had a discipline that suited her down to the ground.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I understand why she is one of your wonders. But number five, charity shops / fashion. Are these two different things you couldn't decide between them? Or is this your fashion come from charity shops?
I like fashion in charity shops. I like going and looking in. But also, I'm fascinated by people. So there's a few things I get out of charity shops. I like buying clothes from there and, you know, like little, especially like homemade jumpers and knitted jumpers that you go, I don't know what, half the time you're like, I don't know what this is. What this scene's supposed to represent, but I'm having it and I'm going to wear it at Christmas. It's a Christmas jumper I'm going to wear. Mm. But also you see stuff that's left in there and you go, who owned this? What was it for? And I just imagine the person behind it. I've bought like a garage sale in New York. I just bought a box of old photographs. So people had obviously done house clearances. And I was just like, who are these people? And what were their lives like? And I try and sort of imagine their backstory based on either an item that I've got from the charity shop.
I cannot agree with this. You're going to a charity shop and buying other people's old box of photographs. These are the sort of things you want to clear out of your own house to declutter the place. Bring other people's clutter home with you. This is madness.
Oh, no, I'm obsessed. I'm upset. Have you never stumbled across something that someone's left somewhere and gone, who left that? Like, who was reading this book or whose was this? And so I'm fascinated by people. There's one photo of a black and white photo of a very annoyed woman in the pile of, and I was just like, what was the moments that led up to that? She wasn't ready for the photo.
Stop taking my photograph.
Yeah.
And don't keep it lying around the house for years and years and years.
And it'll end up in a garage sale in New York. And this Cockney woman's going to get hold of it. And you know, but yeah, I just, because you get spectacular tat. Someone put up a picture this morning of one of the ones on Nicholson Street has a pair of slippers with the Queen and Philip on either side in bed with a Union Jack blanket. And I'm like, who bought those for someone? Someone obviously went, these are ridiculous. Have them at the charity shop. But you just, I'm fascinated by what's behind that. Like for me, like it's almost like meditative for me walking around charity shops because I'll just... Like, I know what I like, what I might want to buy. And then I look at stuff that I go, I don't know why this exists and who. It was I found a statue once in one in LA that just said, "Dirty old men need love too." And it was like a little figurine. And I was like, someone bought that for some... I mean, presumably a dirty old man. Yeah. But I was like, who's going to have this on display in their house?
And did you buy it and put it on display in your house? Well, you is the answer.
Actually, my friend bought it for me because she thought it was so funny. But I'll also go around looking for like... I like looking for brooches, or I'm often trying to find suffragette brooches and stuff like that, you know, like old jewellery and all of that kind of thing. I'm fascinated with to know that stuff, I like pre-love stuff and secondhand stuff, to know that something's lived and had a life before it's got to me. You know, I get my fair share of new stuff as well, but yeah, there's things that I like.
You've mentioned America a lot in all of these wonders. Do you spend a lot of time in America?
A fair bit, yeah. I mean, I was sort of, I moved there in February 2020, as in I rented an apartment in Hollywooddale.
And was that in order to pursue your film career?
Well,
in
I had a 3-year visa, which just got eaten up by the pandemic. So, you know, and look, people.
But weren't you on hand to do all the British accents for, you know, for all the actors and actresses who couldn't get out there?
Yeah, well, I came. So what happened was I got the place in February 2020 and then I came back in March for a couple of weeks to do a TV thing, some shows in the UK, and then that was it. I couldn't get back out there. So it just, I furnished this little place and gone, okay, well, we're here, we're doing this now. And it was mad also because I turned 40, dyed my hair pink and moved to Los Angeles. And I think if I was a man, people would have gone, that's a midlife crisis.
Yes.
But I'm a woman, so they went, is she having a breakdown? I think she might be having a breakdown. So they're very different things. But yeah, so...
So have you still got the apartment there waiting for you and two weeks left on your visa? Or?
Yeah, no, the visa ran out before the travel ban was lifted. So I'm just doing all of that, which is... This is the admin of my life. I'm sure you're very interested. But yeah, so I'm applying for a new one now. But yeah, I just sort of had to let it go. I had to let my apartment go. And yeah, you know, cry me a river. You're like, cry me a river, Tiffany. We're all in a pandemic. But yes, I like it out there. I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated. Also, America's such a fascinating place because, you know, state to state is kind of like the Wild West, like how people, what the rules are, local government, you know, you can't have an idea of America as a place because it's so individual and separate. So traveling around and you can go, oh, I've done all these coastal places and America's really liberal. And then you go somewhere else and you go, no, it's not. Or you you know, how much a part of life is defined by, you know, I've been in places like Louisiana and that's fascinating as well. It's not on my list, but that's all separated by, there's no state lines, it's parishes.
Okay.
So it's a very religious place.
Yes.
And they have something called open carry discount there, which is if you have a gun, you get 10% off in the shops. 100% if you want.
Yes, I would say, yeah.
So.
Okay. All right. Well, that's charity shops and America. So sixth wonder, birds of prey.
Yeah.
And you're ranging around a lot of different things. So birds of prey. So do you... is it birds of prey as in, you know, as in the movie Kez, or you like seeing them flying around? You're a twitcher, you go,
bit of a twitcher. I love that your reference for birds of prey was the film Kez and not the recent Margot Robbie one. I like that. but yes, I'm sort of fascinated. Oh, okay, well, there you go. Louisiana. When I was in Louisiana, because I love birds of prey, they have something called a turkey vulture. There's a lot of turkey vultures, and they actually vomit as a form of self-defense, which I can appreciate.
Yes.
Turkey vulture vomit is all over the roads and stuff. You'll go around Louisiana and you'll see this. And they're pretty, like, ugly-looking birds, to be fair.
In what circumstances do they... They're defending themselves from what?
An attack.
From another bird, from a human?
Yes, yeah.
From a car driving towards it?
Yeah. As a form of defense. Yeah.
I think people try it on the streets around here. Especially time as well. It would appear.
The Royal Mile late at night. Yeah, yes. I've seen a few people apparently getting into a row with a bin. So, so I first sort of got into it, I think, when I was driving in my car down sort of the A40 or the M40 along that corridor. There's a lot of red kites about. So, like in recent years, there's a lot.
They've come back. Yeah.
And so from underneath, they're very, very distinctive birds because they have this sort of red barring down the side and a fork tail, you know.
Yes.
Not all kites do. I thought they did, but not all kites do. And you can see them and they're like, beautiful. So I became fascinated and just looking up different birds. And, you know, I'll go to like a bird of... I mean, I've been to a few... hides, but it's not. I normally go to a place where they've got like there's one at Loch Lomond. There's a bird of prey centre there, and you can go and see a golden eagle and peregrine falcons, which I've seen a few times out and about driving up the M6. Actually, I think I saw that was where I last saw. So I just started doing this thing where I'm looking for the tail shapes, and that's how you can recognise them in flight.
Yeah,
and I try and take photos and see if I can recognize the calls. But I'm not great at it, but I have a friend who is a twitcher, so if I'm not sure, if I can't quite figure it out, he'll tell me.
They're particularly hard, actually, birds of prey, because they're generally, you know, a single one or two quite a long way away, and then you convince yourself you've seen something. People often see buzzards in the Highlands and they oh, that's a golden eagle. And if you say it was a golden eagle, then there's nobody to say it wasn't.
It's
And same with all these various things. If you're obviously, you know, a little way down the line, so you've got these points. But you can't ever absolutely corroborate that you've got it right, can you?
Well, no, I suppose. I mean, buzzards have distinctive, sort of brown and beige sort of barring sometimes. But then that could also be confused with other birds.
Yeah.
So I think I can tell a buzzard, but maybe not. Sea eagles,
oh yes,
they call them flying barn doors. They're like huge birds. Yes. And the ones that I really want to see, but I would have to go to the is the condor, Andean condor, I think, which are huge birds. And they have this thing. It looks like they're wearing a fur collar. They have like this ruff around their neck. And it's quite, you know, it kind of makes them look like they're in Blackadder.
Yeah.
Like this kind of like, it almost looks like they've got makeup on and a big rough collar. So, I'm just, they're through all kinds of mythology, aren't they? And I just, you know, just seeing them, they're majestic to look at. And I'm fascinated by them.
I had a success once with a white-tailed eagle. I was doing a program, which was a walk. It was a program you walk with your dog and then they film you walking the dog. I can't remember which channel it was on, but they weren't super confident it was a great, you know, watch, because they had, you did, two people did two different walks and you went between the two walks. So I just had to take my dog along. And then we went out to see somebody who was in charge of or supervising the reintroduction of white-tailed eagles on Mull. Ooh. So we set up the shot of me to walk down to meet the guy in the middle of the beach. And we're waiting there, and then a bird flew over. And we went with the expert yet. And we said, well, that's one, isn't it? Isn't that one? Because he'd said before we met, oh, they probably won't. They don't really like flying around much when it's sort of damp weather. And we thought, well, that's a bit of an odd part of the world, the west coast of Scotland, to reintroduce them. But so we thought, we filmed it anyway. And then we walked down to, and he said, oh, yeah, that's right. That was a white tail. So I'm talking to him as the expert. And it was like being at a cocktail party when you're looking over the shoulder of somebody. And because I looked over his shoulder and it was coming back the way with a fish in its claw, you know, with a claw.
Oh, wow.
And we got two. And nobody would have believed, because normally you have to spend weeks, you know, hiding, waiting to get these. We got them just by turning up. We shot it even before the thing had really begun, and then again in the middle of the conversation. But whether people were impressed, I don't know. But
I think they would be. They should be, yeah.
They should have been, yes.
I saw an osprey, I think, at Inverary, and that was quite exciting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just sometimes remember places by seeing, you know, what I might see.
Right.
But, the most common one I see is red kites, because they're the ones near where I live. But also, I like the cheekiness of a red kite. There's lots of stories about them swooping in and nicking sausages off barbecues and stuff like that.
Yes.
So, although I did take someone's small dog. This woman said, I think she had like a little Pomeranian and she was in the park with it and she just saw this like kind of shadow pass over her.
Yes.
And then the red kite had picked it up and she had to sort of wrestle the dog back. And then she said 2 days later it was there again. And I was like, maybe go to a different park? I don't know.
A bigger
dog. I don't want to be
too
judgmental, but if your dog's just had a run-in with a, they are quite a lot when they like kind of, you know, if you've ever been to a bird of prey centre and you see them out, they like, you know, they throw the meat for the birds to catch, and you know, like, they're quite scary coming at you.
There was a time I had two dogs. One was a Newfoundland and one was a West Highland White Terrier, and we had crows around my way in London, and the crows would dive bomb dogs, and the Newfoundland was a rather, well, a feeble dog from that point, and she would shy away and run home if attacked by the crows. The West Highland White would just go and they would go away, as he did that to any other animal that ever came near him. Big dog, horse, cow, bull. I've told this before, but he was a fabulous dog. And how he had the personality to, or dogality to just drive people away like that. I wish I had that power. Anyway, birds of prey.
Ravens, they remember, I think. Is it ravens or crows? Someone who's more expert on birds will know that they recognise facial features features, and they have memories and they hold a grudge. So I feel very connected to that.
Okay. Anyway, you find them birds of prey.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Just though, you're the smaller birds.
I love all kinds of birds, but I think there's something exciting and dangerous about the birds of prey.
So we've got one final wonder to do, and it's the High Line in New York City, another American thing, York City. So this is a former railway track that is now a walkway.
Yes. And basically you can walk along and see just a lot of New York at an elevated thing, and then you just see all different people from all parts of New York walking along there. Hence the you know, earlier on when I was talking about the tour guide, that was on the High Line. So he had his little walking group. So, and there's plants and there's flowers, and then there's, you know, street art and graffiti, and you can see things that used to be obviously clearly factories that are now people's apartments. And if you're nosy like I am, I think that's what we've discovered with my charity shops and my old photographs, you can wander along the High Line and see into people's living rooms.
Yeah.
And you know, you can see the Hudson and you can see bits of New York. You can see there's a cafe and the is it Frankie and Johnny from that film? That's like kind of walking along there. So you can get all of these like film locations and stuff like that just walking along. And it's what I love about it is completely free. So, you know, just completely free to go and just see New York in a way that you might not have known about otherwise. I always sort of get on down by Chelsea and then walk along and take in as much as I can of the city. I love New York. It's a fascinating place to me, and I love the breadth of the architecture, the people, all the different people, you know, good, bad, you know. The High Line just is a chance to. I sort of wish we had something like it in London. I think there was an attempt, wasn't there?
There was going to be a garden bridge they were going to build. I think that was one of Boris's ideas.
Yep.
And on Joanna Lumley, actually.
Yes. Lumley and Boris tied back in together.
Yeah. And there is a railway line that goes from Finsbury Park, or used to go from Finsbury Park to Alexandra Palace, and that's a walkway as well.
Yes, park walk.
Yes, but that's rather more suburban, I suppose, than the one you're talking about in New York, which is Manhattan, isn't it?
So, yes, there is a bit of that park walk where it does kind of, because I live in Muswell Hill, it does sort of open out onto, you can kind of see out across London and you can see the Shard and stuff like that. But it's not quite as, not like in the midst of, like if we had something like that in Soho, probably, even, you know, around that sort of way, that would be quite something.
Right. I think all cities should have these extra bits of linear parks and things in it. And most of them have got abandoned railways or things like that.
Yeah, and that it's free and that everyone can come, and people do little projects and stuff there as well.
Look, Tiff, we've come to the end. We've gone beyond the end. Thank you for sharing your seven wonders with me. I now have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it on this podcast. And they've all been fascinating in their own way, a rather eclectic mix. But I think I should, just in loyalty to the track that we aren't using, I think I should go with Fleetwood Mac, because I think you made a very good case for them being the rock group of rock groups and therefore your wonder of wonders. But thank you very much, Tiff Stevenson.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production. in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.